It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be talking with Simply Folk host Stephanie Elkins. She's got some great song suggestions to share with us, and we'll want to hear yours, too.
Right now, we're continuing our conversation with Jay Heck about redistricting reform in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you.
Are you in support of reforming the process, or do you think the system in place is working just fine? You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Jay, we shouldn't go too much farther without talking about what exactly you're proposing with what's being called the Iowa reform. What does the model look like?
Sure. In Iowa, the redistricting reform is still the province of the Iowa legislature, but the actual map drawing is done by the Legislative Services Bureau, which is the same thing as the Legislative Reference Bureau in Wisconsin. And but the difference is that the Legislative Services Bureau in Iowa is not allowed to use partisan political considerations when they draw the maps, and they have to do things like keep cities and communities of interest together, counties intact if possible. When you look at the map in Iowa, it's a series of squares, a lot of right angles. They're districts that make sense. When you look at Wisconsin or Illinois, you see lizards and salamanders and things reaching out to grab this township or this town for purely partisan reasons. And the way it works in Iowa, and I'm not really sure why the leadership is so frightened of this, is that it's still an up or down vote by the legislature in passing the maps, but they're not allowed to amend them. And if they don't like the first map, then the Legislative Services Bureau draws another map. It does some tweaks. What's remarkable, though, in Iowa, Veronica, is that it's been in place since 1980, so four redistricting processes. It's never gone past a second vote and usually passes on the first vote. And it results in competitive elections. Republicans and Democrats both embrace it in Iowa. The people of Iowa have confidence in the system. They're given choices at election time. There are communities that stay together. You know, the city of Beloit, under this new map, has three different state representatives. They've divided the city, so there's really no Beloit representative. Same with Monroe, Wisconsin.
Well, I guess one question would be, how do we make sure that the independent organization that's drawing the district doesn't become partisan just based on who's running it?
Right, because, well, these are legislative reference bureau. They're civil servants. And as I say, they have to abide by pretty strict criteria. They don't have license to sort of draw maps the way they feel like it. They have to, as I say, keep communities intact, keep counties together if possible, abide by the Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act, and they cannot use partisan considerations. In other words, they may draw the maps in such a way that the hometown of one legislator is not even in that district anymore. But that's how you have to do it, and that's why. And the results, though, speak, I think, for themselves in Iowa. There's great confidence by both political parties and by all of the citizens of Iowa in their system. There's very little confidence in elections in Wisconsin anymore, and I would argue that unless we change the process here in Wisconsin, that you're going to see a continued deterioration of the state of our politics and more polarization. One final point, if you don't have competitive general elections, all the action occurs in primary elections, and in primary elections on both the Democratic and Republican side, the more extreme candidates who are less willing to compromise and move to find a common solution are the ones that are normally elected. And you end up with paralysis and polarization, which is something we're now experiencing in Wisconsin.
I want to go to the callers now and get their voices in on this. Let's take Jerry in La Crosse. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I'm extremely happy that you are, selling this idea. I think it's one of the most important things for our democracy to I think it moves the political conversation more to the middle, which is where most people are.
Correct.
I am concerned, though, with what rules this committee is given. I mean, if it were me, I would give the committee the rules that every district should be as competitive as possible.
Right.
But it sounds like the rules they're given are somewhat different. Could you go into that in more detail?
All right. Well, thank you, Jerry.
Sure. And it's a great question. In Iowa, the competitiveness is not a direct goal. It's the result. And I think that's what you want to strive for in Wisconsin, because the problem is that if you begin to draw districts so that they are only competitive but don't keep communities of interest intact, you don't keep towns together with their suburbs, and the districts don't make sense, then you also end up with lizards and salamanders and that type of stuff. But the result, if you do it with no political consideration involved, is that the elections are more competitive. And again, the case in Iowa demonstrates that, whereas we have only 15 of 99 assembly districts that are remotely competitive, the figure's closer to 30 of lesser assembly districts in Iowa. Half of their congressional districts are competitive. Zero, none of Wisconsin's are. So it's a tricky question. I think it would be a much harder rock to push uphill, though, if we were to adopt that competitive criteria.
All right, I want to go back to the phones now, and let's take David with us in Madison. Hi, David.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the good effort of your guest. However, if you would indulge me, please, I actually ran in Iowa in a congressional election. I was the Democratic nominee for the 2nd District of Iowa for the U.S. House of Representatives in 2004. I ran against an old-time moderate Republican by the name of Jim Leach, who was a wonderful man and is now the National Endowment for the Humanities chair and a visiting professor teaching a course at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. However, the recent note, and I know I was stumped by Jim Leach, but I was the last person to lose to Jim.
Yeah. He lost that to the next election, yeah.
He lost the very next one after a fellow who I had held the local elective office. The fellow who ran after me and won had never had any office. He followed me around the last 2 months in 2004, and so the grassroots thing worked in the wave election was 2006. But the point on the redistrict is this.
Mm-hmm.
I've read recently the Wisconsin State Journal, others, now this guest here, saying that the Iowa plan is it would be a great improvement. I beg to differ, and here's why. It's not a panacea. In fact, would there be more competitive elections, a fair process? Some of the time, yes. The Iowa, the analog to the Legislative Bureau of Wisconsin in Iowa basically turns it over to University of Iowa geography people, and they keep counties intact, and they make the most sensible geographic, not competitive, as your guest said correctly, but geographic districts, not just for the Congress, but also for the Iowa legislature at both the House and Senate levels. What happens is, though, is that this does not, there are, as he correctly stated, there are two cracks at it. They come up with two possibilities, and the legislature and the governor can say yes or no, all or none, on the two possibilities. If it goes to the third round, it goes to the legislature right where it is in Wisconsin. And the only reason that it's worked going the first couple of cracks with what the geography people have written in Iowa is since this new system in Iowa has been instituted, one house has been in control during the redistrict of one party, and the other house in the other party.
All right, we're going to have to leave that there, David. I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. And Jay, I want to get your response on this, but we've got just about a minute left.
Well, it's a great response, but one thing that the caller, and he's right, I think, on almost everything he said, but it was passed in 1980 with full Republican control of both houses of the legislature and a Republican governor. And the reason it works in Iowa is there's great fear to not abide by the system and try to step outside of it and say, you know, I want this to be more partisan. The people of Iowa have grown to expect a system that makes sense geographically with a resultant more competitive elections. Iowa's not perfect, but it is a vast improvement over what we have here in Wisconsin. And I'm frankly excited about the fact that this is now a conversation and there are many people talking about it that never gave it any thought a year ago. And as the Appleton Post Crescent said in their editorial, we're not going away. The papers aren't going away. We're not going away. We'll continue to press for this and we'll tweak it and come up with the best system that we can before 2021.
All right, Jay, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking to Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause in Wisconsin.
Coming up next, we'll talk to the host of WPR's Simply Folk. She's got some great songs to share, and we'll ask for your recommendations as well. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, a look at what it would take to get rid of chemical weapons in Syria.
But first, it's time to share some songs. Stephanie Elkins joins us now. She's the host of Simply Folk. You can hear her Sunday from 5 to 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio, but she's here right now with us to share some of her favorites.
And we want to hear from you. Is there something you can't stop listening to, folk music or any genre? Something you're trying to get everyone else to check out or an all-time favorite? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Stephanie Elkins is with us. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rob. And first of all, I just have to say such a wonderful congratulations on the show.
Thanks.
To go from the Middies to redistricting to folk music. It's just a great magazine and a wonderful service for Wisconsin listeners.
And it's been a lot of fun, I got to say. I'm having a lot of fun doing this.
Good.
Well, and the music you've picked, we've got some fun and some serious stuff, too. You gave us a few selections that we pulled to play on the air. Pick one to start with and tell us why.
Well, folk music really does a great job of telling stories and putting us into context in time and place and events. And one thing that's on the minds of so many of us right now is canning stuff from the gardens, whether it's tomatoes or the never-ending zucchini or fruits and so forth. So I picked a song called Canned Goods. It was written by Greg Brown, and we're going to hear an excerpt from it. Do you want to start with that, or would you rather talk about it a little first?
That sounds great. Well, actually, let's wait a second. I guess you mentioned this is one of your most requested songs on Simply Folk.
It is. We get a request for this about every other month. We have a request show once a month, and I have to at least put it on hiatus once in a while. But it's one of those songs that touches you emotionally because it talks about your grandmother putting this summer into the jars. And so you taste the summer, you taste the thunderstorms, you taste the rain, you taste the heat. And it's really an emotional kind of a song.
All right, well, let's get a taste of it now.
Let those December winds bellow and blow. I'm as warm as a July tomato. There's peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bin. Supper's ready, everybody come on in. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. You can taste a little of the summer. My grandma put it all in jars.
Well, you're right about how folk music tells stories. I listen to a lot of rock music, other genres. Nothing else seems to have the capacity to set you up like that and give you that story.
It does. It really puts a picture in your mind. And in this case, he goes on to sing about there's pickles and sweet pickles and dill pickles and the morning dew and the evening moon. He really he takes nature and he puts it in your mind visually, and he puts it in your ears musically, and it's really it packs a very powerful emotional punch.
That was Greg Brown. Canned Goods was the title of the song. I had canned food in my head. Canned Goods is the name of that.
Canned Goods, that's right.
If you have a song recommendation while you're listening and thinking, oh, I want to share something with you guys, give us a call. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. We're playing Share a Song right now. You don't have to sing it to us. Just give us the name, title, and why you like it. Okay, so from Canned Goods, what else did you bring for us today?
Well, everybody likes a good train song. I did a train show, a couple of months ago, and I couldn't believe the response. People suggesting even more train songs and talking about riding the trains as youngsters. I think there's some kind of a mystique about just getting on the train and going somewhere. Looking out the window, it's a journey. And so I've picked one of my very favorite train songs, and it's called City of New Orleans. And Rob, you and I were talking about it before I started this show. I thought it was written by Arlo Guthrie.
So did I.
He's the one who popularized it, but it was actually written by a Chicago songwriter named Steve Goodman.
And This is a heavily covered song. I know the Arlo Guthrie version. Willie Nelson had
yes,
a pretty popular
did. Yes,
one.
He sure did.
This is one people keep coming back to in the folk world.
They sure do. And I think there's a reason. One of the main reasons is that the song really gives you the rhythm of the rails. And that's one of the lines in there. There's, you know, mothers are rocking their babes to sleep, and the rhythm of the rails makes you feel, you know, comfortable. And so, you get this visual and you get this musical sense of the rhythm of the railroad, and you get this it's a great story. And it's a little bit sad, too, because they talk about the disappearing railroad, you know.
Well, you've suggested the Arlo Guthrie and Pete Seeger live version, City of New Orleans. Let's give a listen.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, three conductors, 25 sacks of mail.
And I didn't include, when I pulled the segment for this, my favorite line in the song: the sons of Coleman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpets made of steel. I mean, it brings a tear to my eye, actually. It's just such a wonderful phrase.
It's a great line, and Steve Goodman was one who just, he did that in song after song. He did songs about Mayor Daley and songs about the dying Cub fans' last wish, and he was a brilliant, brilliant lyricist. He left us too early, died of leukemia quite early, but we have a legacy of wonderful songs.
I'm going to bring in a caller before we get to your third selection. Nathan is with us in Arkdale. Nathan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Really good. What did you want to share with us music-wise?
I think more people need to listen to David Lindley.
David Lindley, what's his genre? What's his style?
He plays a bunch of different acoustic instruments, and he's from California. And a song that comes to mind is Seminole Bingo, which is a cover, actually. But David Lindley, he's just wonderful.
And what is it that grabs you that he does? What is it that makes you want to share him?
Well, his vocal style and his finger style of playing, and he plays the Hawaiian guitar on his lap, and it's just really magical.
I'm going to check that out. Lindley, can you spell the last name for me so I can hunt it down successfully?
Sure, Lindley.
Lindley. Thank you so much for that suggestion. Appreciate it. Well, speaking of distinctive vocal stylings, that's a good setup for the third track you suggested to us, Stephanie.
It sure is. And I mentioned that folk music does such a great job of marking events. And this coming Sunday is the 50th anniversary of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. And Richard Farina wrote a song about that. It's called Birmingham Sunday. And Joan Baez, his sister-in-law, did the version that got so much attention. And it's you hear the juxtaposition of her beautiful, clear soprano voice with these awful lyrics about blood in the streets and the choirs trying to sing about freedom. And so it's a powerful, very powerful, emotional song.
Let's give a listen. Joan Baez, Birmingham Sunday.
Come round by my side and I'll sing you a song. I'll sing it so softly it'll do no one wrong. On Birmingham Sunday the blood ran like wine, and the choir kept singing of freedom.
Well, I see what you mean, the distinction between, I mean, that voice sounds like it should be singing something happy, but obviously it's telling a really horrible story about Birmingham Sunday.
And somehow that makes the song even more powerful, because you're hearing it in this almost innocent kind of a voice telling this horrible story of the bombing, and all of a sudden their building shook. And it's a story song, and there are many, many, many examples of these powerful story songs in folk music.
So, obviously, people can go to you on Simply Folk on Sundays to hear songs you pick for them. Tell us a little bit about if they want to share a song with you during Simply Folk.
Well, that's how I hear some of the best songs, is because listeners can make requests once a month. It's a whole three-hour show of listener requests, and that's the second Sunday of every month. And sometimes one will get played and somebody will request it again, and then I'll put it on a playlist, and all of a sudden it's become really popular in Wisconsin. So I'd love to hear from you. The number's 800-654-FOLK, or you can email me at simplyfolk@wpr.org.
Well, I went to you just a little while ago today and asked you for some music to go out with, which we'll play in just a little bit. You gave us an instrumental by Bella Fleck.
Bella Fleck. He's just a virtuoso of every genre, jazz, classical, folk, and this is called...
Cheese Balls in Cowtown. I assume the name is part of why you picked it for us here in Wisconsin. All right, we'll pick that up in just a couple of minutes. Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
And some great suggestions, too. Well, thank you. If you want to share a song, you can continue the conversation. Go over to the Central Time Facebook page. Share a song you want other people to check out. Maybe put up a link if you can find one to it. We'd love to give a listen. Maybe we can check it out on a future show. We'll bring up Cheese Balls in Cowtown by Bella Fleck now under us. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And the news is coming up next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the future of investigative journalism with a guest from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
But first, we're talking with a chemical weapons expert about the latest news on Syria.
Reports say that Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has accepted a Russian proposal to turn over all of his country's chemical weapons.
While there's skepticism from the U.S. government, unnamed officials have said that this could prevent an American military strike against Syria.
But how would all this work? Here to help us break down that question is Paul Walker, Director of Environmental Security and Sustainability for Green Cross International. He's also a member of the Board of Directors of the Arms Control Association. Arms Control, I should say. Paul Walker, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Glad to be with you.
So first of all, what's your reaction to the news this afternoon that Syria agreed to disclose the location of its chemical weapons, halt production, and show its facilities to the international community?
You know, I think this is very good news. It's sort of the one option that President Bashar al-Assad in Syria has, I think, to escape a really major military attack from the United States and allied forces. So I think it's an excellent step forward. Syria has dodged trying to join the Chemical Weapons Convention for 20 years now, since it first opened for signature in 1993. And it also puts pressure if he joins and we go in and can identify and inspect his weapons, it puts tremendous pressure then on Israel and Egypt, which are also two countries of the remaining seven which have never joined the Chemical Weapons Convention.
Well, it seems like a really tall order in the heat of the moment, in the midst of a war within Syria. The notion that outside inspectors could get in, figure out what all weapons, chemical weapons Syria had, verify that they've all left the country. How the heck do you get started doing something like that?
Well, the first thing is that President Assad has to accede to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and he can do that given his dictatorship. He can sign a document and join the convention, really almost overnight, I would think. And then under the convention, he has to, within 30 days, declare his whole stockpile, and that includes each individual munition has to be, you know, location, type, agent. He has to declare all of his production facilities related to chemical weapons production and all of his laboratories and research and development as well, and all of the launch systems he may have to launch chemical weapons. If he does that, which it sounds like from the news that he's willing to do, then the next step is that the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is the multilateral implementing agency in The Hague in the Netherlands, has to review that documentation and verify whether it's fully accurate and comprehensive. And if it's not, typically it is. You know, all but one of the declared possessor countries have fully declared their stockpiles up to now. Libya being the exception a few years ago. If it's comprehensive, then they can move right forward and start sending in OPCW inspectors to inventory the whole stockpile, really barcode so to speak, every single weapon and begin to lock down all the facilities until a destruction program can be worked out.
How hard would it be for a current signatory of the treaty, much less Syria, to keep some stockpile secret, to report some of what they got, but to produce and store chemical weapons outside of the purview of the Chemical Weapons Convention?
Well, the OPCW, you know, can only really inspect whatever the state party, the country, in this case Syria, declares. So when inspectors go into a member country, they inspect everything that's been declared, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, as we say. But they're not authorized to go searching, you know, like a detective for other facilities. So in this particular case, where you have Syria, which has been suspected of having chemical weapons for a long, long time, and now, you know, a few months ago declared that they had a chemical weapons stockpile, and has allegedly used it as many as, you know, 10 or 15 times in the last 6 months, I think it would probably have to be, whatever their declaration was, would have to be very carefully compared with intelligence reports from other countries, namely the United States and Israel and other European and Russia as well. And if, in fact, we felt that there was some facility missing from their declaration, under the Chemical Weapons Convention, one can then request a challenge inspection, as long as they're a member of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And so a challenge inspection would likely be declared by the United States or Russia or some group of countries, and the OPCW inspectors are obliged then to go in and inspect that site, wherever it might be, within 48 hours. So I think a full declaration is actually quite implementable and quite enforceable as well. The big challenge, Rob, would really be the long-term destruction program.
And that was my next question. Suppose this happens, a military strike from the U.S. is averted, Syria really does reveal its entire stockpile, its production system. Then what? How do you get this stuff out of the country? How do you dispose of it?
Well, I think the number one question is, first of all, what's in the stockpile? So you have to determine, you know, what agents are there? Are they blister agents? Are they nerve agents? You secondly have to determine whether, in fact, they're weaponized or not. Are the agents in bulk storage, in barrels and containers, or are the agents in blister and nerve agents in weapon systems? The third question is, if they're in weapon systems, are the weapon systems also, do they also contain explosives and rocket propellant, which is the case in most of the American weapons we have here in the United States? And so once you answer those questions, you can determine what technologies may be relevant to destroy the stockpiles and whether you can transport the stockpiles at all. In most cases, certainly in both Russia and the United States, which are the two big chemical weapon possessor states, transport to any major transportation has been fully prohibited. So destruction facilities then have to be constructed in situ, sort of at the site, within, in the best of cases, a few hundred yards of whatever the stockpile depot is. So that may necessitate the construction of not one, but several destruction facilities of various types. Any sort of transportation of the stockpile is probably prohibitive, unless it's non-weaponized. In other words, you're not dealing with weapons, you're just dealing with agent, or better yet, it's not even agent. It's actually precursor chemicals, which I think some reports have said a lot of his stockpile may be in precursor chemicals, which are not as dangerous because they have to be mixed together first to form live agent. So if it's precursor chemicals, which are industrial chemicals, basically toxic, very toxic but and dangerous, but not a weapon, some of that could be transported to a central destruction facility, or even out of the country, if they wanted to build the destruction facilities in a contiguous country. But we're not talking, you know, moving these weapons to Russia or any distant place. I think at the most, you'd be talking about moving them perhaps into a more secure location within Syria, or, you know, one might even consider across the border into Turkey or Jordan. But I think it's likely that destruction would have to take place in Syria, because this is a dangerous operation. And then the question is, you know, under the civil war circumstances, could we in fact guarantee the safety and security of the inspectors, which have to be there on site 24/7 as long as destruction takes place, and or and the construction workers, which would have to be there to build the facilities.
This is not something that's going to happen fast. Roughly, what would the timeline be if every step went well, from the diplomacy to getting the inspectors and the people destroying these weapons on the ground?
You know, I think in the best of cases, we'd have a full declaration and an inventory on the weapons probably within 2 to 3 months. I think that's kind of the time frame. We're not talking weeks. I think we're talking months in this case. And for destruction of the facilities, we'd be talking years. So I think in the best of cases, probably, depending on the size of the stockpile, probably 3 to 5 years is what it is. It's just a rough estimate. I mean, the United States, you know, has been destroying its stockpile, which is much larger, but has been destroying its stockpile for 23 years now. And we still have another 10 years to go, at least. So we're talking 33 years in the case of the United States. But that's a stockpile that's probably maybe 25 to 30 times the size of the Syrian stockpile. In the case of Russia, Russia's been destroying its stockpile, which is 40 times or more the alleged size of the Syrian stockpile, for the last 12 years, and still has probably another 5 to 10 years to go.
Paul, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
That's Paul Walker. He's with Green Cross International, led the effort to establish the Chemical Weapons Convention Coalition.
Coming up, we'll talk about how investigative journalism is faring in the changing media landscape. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hear all the time that the media landscape is changing and that journalism is struggling to survive.
Well, the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters is taking on that question tonight with a panel discussion about the future of investigative journalism.
Investigative journalism is often seen as the crown jewel of the media industry. It uncovers secrets, wins Pulitzers. So, what role is it going to play in the future?
The Wisconsin Academy's panel will be at 7 o'clock tonight at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. Bill Leaders, the Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, will be taking part in the event, and he's here with us now to talk about the future of his trade. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism partners with Wisconsin Public Radio. And Bill, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Good to be here again.
So we hear a lot that traditional media is struggling in this digital age, but what do you see as the biggest challenges facing investigative journalism in particular?
Well, investigative journalism is often long-form journalism. It's a journalism that takes longer to produce. Usually it involves a lot of research, a lot of digging, usually some document work, sometimes some number analysis and data analysis. It takes a long time to do, and it's more difficult for media organizations these days to devote resources to that type of reporting, which is why groups like ours, like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, have come into being, because we provide some of the content to newspapers that can't devote that level of resources to this type of reporting anymore.
Well, we live in an era, too, when things seem to be getting increasingly bite-sized. People want news that they can digest quickly. Now, is that impacting the impact, I guess, and the staying power of investigative journalism?
Well, I think there's a place for long-form journalism and for investigative journalism. I think if you ask people, in fact, if you look at surveys of readers of newspapers, one of the things they'll invariably say they want is more investigative journalism, more long-form, in-depth journalism, and I think there is a audience for that. It's harder sometimes for people to devote attention to long stories than to short ones, but I think people do understand that there's value in a longer, more deeply researched piece of work.
Now, we had on Henry Blodgett, the CEO and editor-in-chief of Business Insider, not too long ago. And I don't know if you happened to see his piece, but he also went on a cable news show talking about how we are entering, he thinks, a golden age of journalism, and that the information is more widely accessible, more people are doing it, and there's lots of upsides and platforms. Do you share that view?
I do. I absolutely do. People talk all the time about how media organizations have gotten crunched, how newsrooms that used to have, you know, 70 reporters now have 30. And that's true. The size of news staffs has been cut back dramatically in all media, broadcast media and print media. But I think one thing that's also happened is the journalists who remain have been forced to up their game. They work harder. They do a better job of providing more within a small amount of time. And technology, to some extent, allows us to do that. When I started off in this business, if I wanted 25, 30 years ago, if I wanted to find an article that ran in the local paper, say, 8 months before, that would meant biking over to the public library and looking it up in an index and then finding the microfiche and threading through the machine and then getting a printout of it. You know, would take an hour to do what you can now do in a couple of seconds with the access of the internet. And I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of efficiencies that have been brought to the task of gathering and using information. And so reporters can do better. They can do more.
And yet you're talking about how there are fewer journalists in the newsroom. So does it make it less likely that, you know, young people are going to go into journalism and get trained and therefore less likely to produce, you know, another Woodward and Bernstein?
Well, I don't know. I think that the center is producing some Woodward and Bernsteins right now. I think our internship program shows that there are young people who are capable of being good and even great journalists, and that they're knocking on the door. They're looking for opportunities, and we can train them. We can make them realize their potential as journalists, as writers, as communicators, and they will go on to do great things.
What about making money? Because it seems like that's something that, you know, newspapers, look at the New York Times even, are struggling with. How do they make money off their content when it goes digital? And I would imagine that would be something that impacts investigative journalism particularly.
Well, we have to use a completely different model. We're not using the model of ordinary media, which is you sell advertising to support your activity and you sell subscriptions to support it to some extent. We give away our content to media across the state that want to use it, and we're entirely funded by donations and particularly grants. We're supported by people who see a value to investigative journalism, and that allows us to fill this niche that is out there in the market.
So is part of the answer more centers like yours across the country?
I think it is. There was that movie about the New York Times, I think it was Front Page, a few years ago, and it spoke specifically about the advent of the nonprofit investigative journalism centers being an increasingly important part of the new media terrain. There needs to be groups like ours to operate, you know, at the state level or at the level of within various interest groups that want to do this type of reporting, and they're thriving. They're springing into being in abundance, and many of them are doing well. I think the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is doing particularly well. We've grown steadily. We have a tremendous amount of reach and impact, and the future looks bright.
And yet the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism was in the news this summer because of its proposed removal from the UW system in the past budget. Now, that didn't come to pass, but was that seen as a blow to the center? How did you interpret it from where you are?
Well, you can look at it a couple of ways. You can look at it as a largely unfair and unfortunate attack that was predicated on misunderstanding or ignorance. And that's not a good thing. I mean, that was a very dispiriting thing to happen, particularly to be dragged into this this issue and into somebody's ideological battlefield. I found that very, very dispiriting and unfortunate. On the other hand, we received tremendous outpouring of support, literally from all over the country, from journalist organizations and from media outlets throughout the state. Dozens of people weighed in from the University of Wisconsin system, and our colleagues in the media, our partners, they all rallied very strongly to our defense. And in the end, Governor Walker vetoed the provision that would have kicked us out of the University of Wisconsin. And we think that was the right thing to do.
Got a question here from Willem in Colfax, who wants to know, how has corporate sponsorship of media impacted investigative journalism?
Well, corporate sponsorship isn't a part of our funding. We don't receive any money from any corporations.
But more broadly?
More broadly, I think that there is a need for media to focus in on how giving by corporations distorts the process, whether it's the political process or whether it's the academic and scientific process, or in some cases, the journalist process. If you're talking about corporate ownership of media, these are influences that affect the media and affect all other aspects of society. I think we're relatively free from those influences, and that's one of the advantages that we have. We're not beholden to any corporation.
Can you give me a sense about how many centers like yours there are across the country?
I believe there's about 50. I could be wrong on
maybe
that.
Maybe one in each state? Or
yeah,
are they clustered?
Many of them are state-based, and some of them are oriented around particular issues that that they want to do an investigation on.
Well, moving to how the media is doing right now, as a watcher and a journalist, how would you rate the media's performance lately when it comes to covering some of the big issues of the day, like Syria, evolving conflicts in the Middle East, climate change? What do you think when you sit back and look?
I'm proud to be a journalist. I think that my colleagues in the media do a terrific job. We do have less time sometimes to do stories than we once did. We sometimes have constraints that we didn't once have to contend with. But I think we've, by and large, risen to the occasion and maintained our professionalism and continue to provide something of value to our society.
And Bill, about 30 seconds, any advice you'd give young journalists out there?
Work hard. learn the craft and work hard at it. You're going to get better by doing it. And that's the only way you're going to get good at it.
All right. Well, Bill Leaders, thank you so much for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Bill Leaders, Money and Politics Project Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And that panel discussion about investigative journalism will be held at the Wisconsin, held by the Wisconsin Academy of Arts, Letters, and Science. That's tonight, 7 o'clock, at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the realities of working-class adulthood in an age of uncertainty.
We'll also hear why we need quiet to think clearly in today's noisy world.
And we'll learn how museums are making the leap to the online world.
Tune in tomorrow. That's all coming up on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the science behind modern-day attempts at immortality. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.